This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Portland, where the time is now 8:03. Coming up next is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, hosted by Joe Uris. Today's guest is Metro Councilor Bob Stacey, who will talk about the Columbia River Crossing. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Aladdin Theater, presenting Alligator Records rhythm and blues artist Tommy Castro and the Painkillers, 8 p.m. Thursday, March 14th. Tickets and information for Tommy Castro and the Painkillers at the Aladdin box office and aladdin-theater.com.
Yes, a bridge over troubled waters, maybe a troubled bridge over less troubled waters. I don't know. This is KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial here in Portland, Oregon. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with Abe Proctor and me, Joe Uris. Abe ain't here, but we do have a guest to talk about the Columbia River Crossing, which is our topic for today. Our guest is Metro Councilor Bob Stacey.
Good morning, Joe.
Good morning. And I'm just treat me like a the ignoramus I am. What Ooh. Is the Columbia River Crossing? What is its history? What will it cost? What will it do? And what's wrong with it, if anything?
Big assignment. Well, first of all, congratulations on the nice lead-in music. I know you didn't mean it at all, ironically.
No, not at all.
Very restful.
Not at all.
The Columbia River Crossing is the former name of the project proposed to replace the I-5 crossing of the Columbia River. So
okay, now I just want to remind people the I-5 crossing is two drawbridges, one built earlier than later, and they're duplicates of each other, except maybe the technology is a little different, and that they are basically piers sunk
wooden piers in that don't in most cases go all the way to the bedrock, so they're sitting unconsolidated material, sand and silt. They were built, I think, in 1917, and the second one opened in 1958.
Yes.
So one of the arguments for this project is to do something about bridges that are old and allegedly built with substandard practices. But it starts earlier than that. That's a current argument for this project. But a decade ago, more than a decade ago, TriMet was trying to figure out how to complete the vision of a light rail system that went from Vancouver, Washington, to downtown Portland, not simply to the Expo Center, the Yellow Line's current terminus, and hit upon the idea that maybe the two departments of transportation wanted to do something along the I-5 corridor. Maybe there was a partnership here. And along the way, the senior partners, the departments of transportation, were able to get their priorities first in the mix. But it starts with this idea that maybe there's something in this for everybody. Transit advocates who want to see a complete regional network of transit, highway advocates who want to see freer flow traffic on the interstate highway system. And maybe you could design some sensible project that could serve both purposes with a mixture of federal highway money, local state highway money, and federal and local transit dollars. That's the early 2000s. Citizens Task Force is appointed, but I give overwhelming credit to one man, Stoll Reeves attorney, senior partner Henry Hewitt, who is a consummate business lawyer and was chair of the Oregon Transportation Commission, who said, you know, there's a deal here. We can figure out how to package a deal, and basically tried to take that, you know, build the pie higher approach of figuring out how you can deliver for every constituent. If that constituent is the trucking industry, you're going to figure out a way to move freight better along the I-5 system. If it's Washington State commuters trying to get to jobs in Oregon, that means higher capacity for peak hour travel. If it's transit, it's building light rail to Vancouver. If it's bicycles and pedestrians, it's building much better facilities in those narrow sidewalks on the existing bridges. And then after that, you've got a package and the job becomes persuasion. So the Citizens Task Force, starting in, I think, about 2004, 2005, various committees, various names, was the persuasive tool. How do we go through a process of looking at alternatives but end up with a bigger freeway bridge and a light rail bridge that meets both of these needs? Along the way, some other interests came to the fore, specifically the bureaucratic interests of the two departments of transportation, who don't like having to operate an operable lift bridge.
Well, why is that?
Well, you know, somebody has to do that.
Yeah. Engineers
like to build things that, once built, can more or less be left alone except for light maintenance until time comes to remove a deck, replace entire pieces of steel. But this thing of every day or several times a week having somebody lift the bridges. You remember in the 1990s, the lifts themselves had worn out, were becoming difficult, and there was a major program that ended up rebuilding and reworking the lifts and the pulleys and all the other machinery.
That.
Another thing that happened during that time, Joe, not to get too far ahead of ourselves, was there was an elaborate program of letting the public know about the closures of these bridges and urging them to take alternative routes or delay their travel, and there were no traffic jams to speak of on I-5 during that period.
Well, that's interesting.
Because people got the word and changed their travel behaviors, meaning that what we have here is an excess of demand for a free good, travel across a bridge, at one point of the day, which can be managed. People can change their habits. They can change their time of travel. They can change the mode of travel. But the idea was fixed that we were going to preserve or expand highway capacity across this bridge, as the Washington State Department of Transportation, Southwest Washington director, put it a few years ago. The problem on I-5 results from the fact that Oregon has never built a nice wide freeway like we have in Vancouver, where it is four lanes wide all the way north for a good distance. And this was going to add even more auxiliary lanes between those interchanges. They need to get busy on their side of the river after this bridge is done and widen I-5 through the rest of Portland. The bridge review team appointed at the end of the process in 2010 to look at the design, which uncovered the fact that a design that was then being forwarded, an open web design, was fatally flawed and could collapse. That team also said, no, we agree. The only long-term solution here, this was a group of highway and bridge engineers, the only long-term solution here is to build eight lanes or more through the city of Portland as a freeway. The entire freeway needs to be widened, not just this bridge.
But that would knock out Lloyd Center.
It would knock out all kinds of things.
Coliseum.
Remember when the Mount Hood Freeway was proposed? That was a mere six-lane freeway. And it would have taken out a full percent of the city's housing stock, and it went about the same distance out to I-205 from downtown. We're talking about massive disruption and massive change in Portland. We're talking about that with this project, too, because we will have 10 lanes on the bridge as redesigned, 10 lanes on the bridge itself. The interchange on Hayden Island will, at its widest point, be 17 lanes.
17 lanes?
17 lanes. There's a lot of weaving that has to be done. And so you have this eight-lane freeway in Washington State, morning peak, people coming into this 10-lane bridge, going through a 17-lane interchange, and then landing on a six-lane I-5 southbound, which narrows to four lanes at the Broadway-Weidler interchange near the Lloyd Center at the arena and the Coliseum.
Well, gee, what's wrong with that idea?
Well, all that means is that we will be backing traffic up all through North Portland, which then means that those motorists who came zooming over the freeway and over this new bridge will peel off to go to Interstate Avenue to take Marine Drive and start or Columbia and start looking for the St. John's Bridge as an alternate route to Washington County. They'll go down Martin Luther King Boulevard, Vancouver. Those streets have Washington license plates now aplenty. They'll have even more when we have 50,000 more cars trying to get across. That's the projection of what's needed. So wise people said, perhaps we need to toll this facility, in part because we need more money to build something this enormous and this expensive, and in part because it may give us a way to manage demand. And that's true. We've seen across the West Coast and across the world that when new bridges are tolled, that actually reduces the amount of traffic crossing them, not just reduces the growth in traffic when there is an alternative route. The most recent example is the SR 520 floating bridge across Lake Washington, where the existing bridge is going to be replaced, so they've started to toll it while the construction is underway for the new bridge. As soon as the toll went on, 40% of the traffic on the bridge disappeared. It went in large part to I-90, a parallel bridge about four and a half miles away. It's still 30% below the former volume of traffic on that floating bridge because there's a toll on the bridge and there's a free alternative. Washington State, last year, in authorizing tolls for a new I-5 bridge, prohibited tolling I-205. So,
Wait a minute. They can't toll 205?
Washington State says, we're not going to toll I-205. We're not going to be part of a deal to toll I-205. And folks in Clark County are very much opposed to tolling I-205. There, many of them are opposed to tolling I-5. The result could be 30 to 40% traffic diversion. It's going to be a significant diversion, which is not so good for residents of Northeast Portland, not so good for commuters on the Banfield Freeway, not so good for folks along Halsey Street and Burnside and Sandy and all the other alternatives to the Banfield Freeway. So we face one of two possibilities. Either we'll have massive congestion in North Portland because tolling doesn't work to change travel behavior and reduce the peak. And the bridge won't have solved any problems. It'll just make congestion move down to a different location.
But it'll be shiny and new.
It'll be shiny and new. But hear me out. The other option possibility is the tolls will work, and we'll see that we didn't really need a bridge so wide to handle the volumes that are going across it because it'll be lower than today's volumes. Those are the conundrums we face with this thing.
Well, wait a minute. What happens if you just go back to tolling the original two bridges?
Mm-hmm. Well, remember, we were trying to get a deal. People on both sides wanted something. And the classic statement of the deal was one made by Mayor Charlie Hales not too long ago. No light rail, no LRT means CRC is DOA, said Mayor Hales. That's the Portland side position. Uh-huh. We want an expansion of our light rail transit network to connect the second largest city in the metropolitan area, Vancouver, to the core. In Clark County, people want a faster way to get to jobs in Oregon. And a lot of folks in Clark County, including elected leaders, oppose light rail, oppose tolling. They think these bridges just ought to be replaced because they're old and rickety and they're too narrow. And you could have higher speed, higher capacity travel. If we decided that the smart thing to do was to keep the existing bridges, which it is, and I can go through some of those details, keep an existing investment, which has at least 50 years of useful life left in those bridges.
Uh-huh.
If you seismically strengthen them, then you've got an indefinite resource there to maintain and to use. Keep those bridges. One idea was use them as the freeway and put a toll on the freeway and build a light rail and local traffic bridge that goes to downtown Vancouver. Now you're talking hundreds of millions of dollars instead of $3.5 billion, because you've kept existing facilities and you've built a much smaller new bridge, which also has a lift, a raisable section of the bridge, like the two existing I-5 bridges. But that wasn't going to meet objectives of the highway departments that didn't want to have a lift span, didn't want to have that operable bridge. It wouldn't meet the concerns of some shippers who use barges, who have to go through a complicated weave pattern on the Columbia River to get underneath the high point of the existing highway bridge, if it isn't lifted, and then underneath the railroad bridge.
But I understand that if they changed the railroad bridge's orientation for its lift,
yeah,
it would be possible for the barges to make a straight line approach,
right,
and there would be many less lifts.
Right.
So
if we go to a bird's eye view again, we've got the two existing I-5 bridges right next to each other,
right,
a northbound bridge and a southbound bridge. Then, I'm going to guess, 3/4 of a mile downstream, a little beyond the middle of Hayden Island, is another bridge, the Burlington Northern Railroad Bridge. It's even lower.
Mm-hmm.
Like the highway bridge right next to the Washington shore, it has a lift span. It has a swing span that
right.
pivots in the middle. And in the wintertime, when there's winds and tricky currents and rain beating down on the windshield of a towboat, those boats pulling long rows of barges want to go underneath that lift span on the highway bridges right next to the shore, and then in a straight line to the swing span on the railroad bridge. You can't get under the railroad bridge with a barge in high water. There's not enough clearance. It's right down at river level. So you've got to go through that swing span.
Uh-huh.
But in good weather, you're coming along the river going toward Astoria. You come underneath a fixed part of the highway bridge. It just happens to be humped, so you can fit a barge and a tugboat underneath it, and then you make a little S curve to hit that swing span. That's just a tricky maneuver in high currents. So it would be ideal to access a fund for navigation improvements that's in the federal budget process. Doesn't have much money in it these days, but 10 years ago it had some, to make improvements to that railroad bridge and put a lift span mm-hmm. that lines up with the high point of the highway bridge. None of those ideas worked for the deal. The railroad company wasn't part of the negotiating team. They weren't going to put any money into it. The Coast Guard didn't want to make improvements to a railroad bridge that primarily benefited highway users, in their judgment, rather than navigation. And again, that meant that the poor departments of transportation would have to keep these old bridges that go up and down instead of having an elegant piece of concrete and steel that doesn't have to be moved or fussed with. And you wouldn't have a wider, faster highway. So it kept moving along in the direction of this grand bargain, which I've likened to an arranged marriage where, you know, neither party really likes the other, but they're in this because they're getting something and they're swallowing hard for the other thing. And it turns out that increasing numbers of Clark County residents are not swallowing light rail, are not swallowing tolls, while Vancouver City remains very, very supportive of the concept. Portland and the government I serve, Metro, have both signed off on it. But people in Clark County.
Oh, those people.
Yeah. From a conservative or even libertarian perspective, who don't think government needs any more money in the form of tolls, and who think that transit is a form of socialism and light rail is simply a more expensive form, are joined by people on the Oregon side, most of them progressives, who are very worried about the community impacts of more traffic, more carbon dioxide gas, more pollutants from tailpipes in neighborhoods in North or Northeast Portland. Even as far south as Clackamas County, people are becoming concerned about the impacts on I-205 from having more traffic, some of it trying to find its way all around the horn on 205 to Washington County. So you have this growing anger and dissent rather than growing agreement. You also have people in the business community on both sides of the river who are very worried about the long-term costs and consequences of a deal that has very shaky financing. This was a deal that was dreamed of in 2005, when the federal government was collecting a gas tax that looked as if it could pay for things, when we weren't on the backside of the Great Recession, when state coffers didn't have a lot of money for highways, but a gas tax increase on a regular basis was still contemplated as state policy, and when TriMet wasn't slashing service and raising fares just to keep alive. We're in a much different economy now. There's actually less driving across that bridge now than there was then. There's less driving overall in the metro area than there was then. Part of that is the economy. Part of it is that people younger than you and I, Joe, are bicycling, using transit, walking, living closer to work, and otherwise adapting to life without or with a reduced use of an automobile. And it's really showing up nationwide as a demographic trend.
Well, go ahead.
The upshot is that we have very different circumstances than the kind of cash and kind of demand that was dreamed of in 2005. Today, we have a federal government that doesn't have $400 million in highway money to put its part into this. There just isn't money available from a program called Corridors of National Significance. The federal government appears potentially poised to grant approval to an $850 million light rail investment in this project. That's the most solid and largest single source of money. But that will depend upon federal appropriations in a Congress that is deeply divided about what looks a lot like an earmark. $850 million is a 100% payment for this project. Nobody else in the country gets 100% of the cost of their light rail from the federal government. They have to make at least a 50% matching payment from local resources. We have this because of Senator Patty Murray. It's not an earmark. It's a rider. It's an amendment. Mm-hmm. And it says, it doesn't say for the CRC. It basically generically describes a situation that sounds an awful lot like the CRC. And in those circumstances, you can get 100% financing. The big problem is from tolls. The tolls are expected, the project depends on the tolls raising at least $1.3 billion of money for project expenses and a whole bunch more money to pay off the interest on the bonds, to pay the operating and collection costs of collecting all those tolls. And if traffic drops 30% instead of continuing to rise, if people do divert to 205, if they do change their behavior, we're not going to get anything like that. Remember the experience on SR 520 across Lake Washington, the 40% drop that stabilized at 30% reduced traffic for the past year, is identical to the experience in California with tolled freeways that are paralleled by free freeways. They don't get their revenue projections. The bonds become junk bonds in California that were backed by these toll revenues. So State Treasurer Ted Wheeler is charged by the legislation that was adopted by the Oregon legislature. Sorry, this history is so jumpy, Joe.
It's okay.
We just finished seeing the Oregon legislature in record time pass a bill requested by the governor, House Bill 2800, to authorize the state's participation in the CRC, the replacement of the two bridges, tearing them down, pulling them out of the river, and building these two replacement bridges with light rail hanging underneath one and pedestrian and bicycle under the other. And the bill charges the Department of Transportation not to sell any bonds for the project until State Treasurer Wheeler has certified that the revenues will be there to pay off the toll bonds that will be able to make $1.3 billion plus the interest. And he has said publicly that he's going to take a very sharp pencil to this. He and his staff looked at the first rough proposal to raise $1.3 billion and said, you know, I see $600 or $700 million here, but I don't see $1.3 billion. And so there's a big onus on the treasurer, but also on the two DOTs, the Department of Transportation in Oregon particularly, to justify their projections that they're going to be able to raise that kind of money, or else the project can't proceed.
Now, I've heard that with the improvement, with the new bridge, the actual commute time between Vancouver and Portland would be improved by 1 minute.
Well, remember, you're going to zip across the bridge, and you're going to hit the neck down to where the freeway returns to six lanes.
Mm-hmm. And then four.
And then four. So even if you're only going to the Fremont Bridge, you've got backup from the Broadway-Widler interchange, extending back up the freeway, you already have the slowdown right at the neck of the bridge. So people will be essentially forced to peel off Marine Drive, Interstate Avenue, MLK exits to try to get out of that mess and take those surface streets through North Portland if they're going to complete their trip in any kind of time.
I have to say, on the surface, it looks to me like a very dubious and very expensive project. I mean, the state of Oregon doesn't have a lot of money to throw around.
The state of Oregon has no money to throw around. The state of Oregon has $100 million less in its highway trust fund every year than it expected to have after raising gas taxes 6 cents in 2009. It thought we were going to have an $800 million program. We've got a $700 million program in terms of new revenues annually. And we're cutting projects and we're deferring maintenance. And you look at the city system, the city is dependent in large part on the state gas tax as well. People blame all that paint we're spending on bicycle lanes. Well, for crying out loud, the city is not receiving the construction value of money that it used to receive from the state gas tax. And so whatever you do, you end up being short. You decide not to participate in replacing the Selwood Bridge. We could have paved some more streets, but then you've got a bridge over there that's falling down. And that's a bridge that's falling down, not a bridge that we'd like to see widened and made super duper. This is a time for prudence. This is a time for making use of what we've got and adding responsibly that which we need to add to it. Let's keep those existing bridges, repurpose them maybe. Maybe put light rail and bike and pedestrian and local traffic on the existing I-5 bridges. They go right toward downtown Vancouver from Hayden Island. The plan already includes a new light rail and local access bridge from Marine Drive over to Hayden Island to bring light rail across to a Hayden Island station. Instead of making that light rail line climb up onto a 116-foot high bridge and hang from its belly, take it across on the existing bridges, and then build a much more modest supplemental freeway bridge that's only three lanes in each direction, maybe four lanes for an acceleration lane for the Vancouver on-ramp that goes across Hayden Island. You don't need an interchange on Hayden Island anymore, or you can keep the existing small interchange and have it open part of the time, because you can avoid that backup that occurs from all that weaving if you have local access to and from the island on surface streets. Now you're talking about a new bridge that costs $500 million, probably.
Wait a minute, that's one-sixth.
You're also going to put light rail on the existing bridge, which will cost a lot less than $850 million.
Right.
If you want to make peace with Washington State, maybe you don't extend it all the way through downtown Vancouver and all the way out to Clark College. Maybe you build a shorter line. Maybe you terminate in downtown Vancouver. These are all ideas that the architects of the common sense alternative have been promoting. Since we haven't gotten any real world thoughtful alternatives from the two departments of transportation, there's emerged a cottage industry in the greater metropolitan area of frustrated, upset, but idealistic architects, planners, engineers who've been spinning out ideas. And Jim Howell and others associated with the Common Sense Alternative have been among the leaders in that. George Crandall, a Portland architect, has worked with Jim to help refine these designs. And they're the proponents of this alternative, which would be an additional bridge next to the two existing bridges. The two existing bridges would be repurposed for light rail and pedestrian and bicycle and the local traffic. And then the through I-5 traffic would be on a lift span, like the Morrison Bridge or the Burnside Bridge, so-called bascule, two leafs that go up in the air, because there are at least three major industries upstream from the bridge that have to have a lift, a passageway, that is greater than the height of the proposed new bridge.
Wait a minute. Three major industries wouldn't be able to get through the newly proposed unlifted bridge system?
Oregon Iron Works and two Vancouver companies fabricate big steel structures. They're used in the oil industry. They're used in a wide variety of industrial applications. And they go out via the Columbia on ocean-going vessels to their destinations after they're constructed and have been to be delivered to their customers. essentially what ODOT and Washington Department of Transportation are saying is, look, we'll give them some money and they'll redesign their construction processes, or maybe they'll find a new place to build, or maybe, more likely, these jobs will just leave the metropolitan area altogether because they've got to find
out. So we lose jobs.
We'll probably lose some of those jobs, absolutely. And the consequence is we know how to solve the problem of a bridge where there's an airport nearby, so planes are going over and you can't go very high, that has occasional really large vessels that have to pass through. We have a lift span to accommodate that. It can stay low and not be in the way of flights. It can lift and therefore allow passage of occasional large vessels, particularly at night and on the weekend when it isn't disrupting the commute. We're not the only place in the world that has this issue. We're not the only place in the world or in the United States that has lift bridges on the interstate system. We're one of eight lift spans on interstate highways in the United States. And the most recently reconstructed was on a freeway that is busier than I-5 in a city that is bigger than Portland, Oregon, across a river that is about as wide as the Columbia. That's the I-95 Woodrow Wilson Bridge in Washington, D.C. They had an old lift span. It needed to be replaced. They didn't replace it with a big high bridge that would require Navy destroyers to bend some mast or something when they went through. They built a replacement lift span. And the big vessels don't go through often enough to disrupt rush hour traffic, nor would they here. It's a very sensible solution. It's used wherever necessary. It's not used every time. You know, the Glen Jackson Bridge isn't as high as this one would be, but it's, you know, it's in a location where you don't have upstream traffic. There are other places where a fixed bridge can go across for the interstate system. This is one of those occasional situations, like the other eight, where it makes sense to keep a lift span in operation.
Well, I guess I want to go to the phones, 231-8187, but I do also, I know you're running out of time.
I can be here another 15 minutes.
Okay. So, and I guess I want you to be here while some questions come in, but I have so
I hope I've confused everybody by now.
No, and I think you've been very clear. What's confusing to me is what appears, now this is my naive, unknowledgeable take on this. It appears to me that the two departments of transportation, the Washington Department and the Oregon Department, are calling the shots. It's like the tail calling the brain on everything. And it looks to me like it's a commitment, an old-fashioned commitment to an old style of solution to a problem that requires some modern thinking. Am I wrong?
You're absolutely right. What's happened here is once the deal was cut nearly a decade ago, all the parties to the deal, the Departments of Transportation, TriMet, some of the local governments in the region, put their shoulders to the wheel of building the case and persuading. It no longer was an inquiry into whether there's a smarter way to do this. So now, 8 years later, legislators in both the Oregon and Washington legislature and the public are being assured that the best experts in the country have looked at this, have pursued many alternatives, had a long, extensive engagement process, and have come up with the very best possible technical solution, and that remaining arguments will simply delay the inevitable, which is a major improvement that is vital to our economy. Now, if you're in the business community, I guarantee you, you're the leader of your company. You don't have the time to review the draft environmental impact statement, the final environmental impact statement, poke holes in this thing. You look across the table at the director of the Department of Transportation, and you say, did you do a careful analysis of alternatives? And the Department of Transportation director says, yes, we did, Mr. CEO. That's good enough for me. I'm going to support this thing.
I have to display a little cynicism here. Isn't there a major construction company that stands to benefit from this project?
Well, I don't know which construction company is going to get the major bid on or make the successful bid on this project, but a number of consulting and engineering and public involvement firms have made significant have realized significant benefit from this project and been the recipients of significant amount of, well, of, dollars.
I mean, 2.5 weeks ago, Willamette Week essentially argued that Patricia McCaig is the go-to person in all of this, and that her employer is, in fact, one of those construction companies.
Well, David Evans and Associates, I think, manages the consultant contract for Patricia McCaig's company, according to the story. And David Evans and Associates is a prime engineering and design and planning consulting firm contractor on this project. So they're not the firm that's going to build it. They're the firm that has shepherded most of the process of approval and explanation and design for the project.
So if you're just tuning in, we're talking about the Columbia River crossing known as the CRC. We're talking with Bob Stacey, who is a Metro councillor, and we're talking about the enormous project across the river with a bridge that is very wide, very expensive, and possibly not the best solution.
Joe, I should say one more thing.
Okay.
I am a Metro councillor. I was elected last year. I took office in January. By that time, Metro had made the decisions it was going to make on the Columbia River crossing, and they're not the decisions I would have made, but I would have been one vote among a group of seven.
No, that's important.
I'm not representing Metro here today. These are my personal views.
I do want to.
Okay.
I'm glad we make that
sure,
clear.
Sure, you bet.
All right. Now, I would like to hear from some of you out there. So who we got? Billy.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
Hey.
Hey, listen, I live in Clark County, and I travel down the I-5 corridor myself, and when I'm going to Intel, I have to backtrack, go all the way through town, and then head back up on 26. Why don't they build a toll bridge from from Woodland, Washington, to St. Helens, and connect it to the backside of the Beaverton, the Alloa area? It would probably alleviate 20-30% of the traffic going through the I-5.
Well, it's an interesting point. I don't know the answer. I don't know if Bob does either. And I don't know the feasibility of that. But it's an interesting point.
Billy.
I mean, just north, because that's where a lot of people are coming from, is from that north Clark County.
Mm-hmm.
And St. Helens and Woodland are pretty close together. It wouldn't take a very big bridge.
Billy, this is Bob Stacey. You could you could build a bridge at St. Helens to connect to Highway 30.
Right.
It would be a significant undertaking. I mean, you do have some wetland issues, some very significant natural areas that you have to cross in addition to the river there. But it's certainly feasible to build a bridge there. If you tied into Highway 30, you would bring traffic down that corridor. And
right.
In terms of access to Portland, Highway 30 still has some capacity. But that bridge would be expensive. It would itself be probably $500 million, just as any crossing of the river would be at a minimum. And then the question you asked is, why couldn't you just cut over to Beaverton? You know, this is an idea that's been talked about for a couple of decades at least, and that's a so-called Western Bypass. We have I-205 right. on the east side, and we have I-5 down the middle, but we don't have something that is continuous on the west side that is built at expressway standards that would connect you from maybe Wilsonville, maybe on the south side of the river, through Washington County and up to Longview or up to, as you said, St. Helens and Woodland. Here's the deal. There is traffic that goes from Clark County to Washington County. And at the rush hour, it's significant, and it really puts an impact on key interchanges and the like. The rest of the day, there isn't a whole lot of volume of traffic, and it can be accommodated by the sort of roundabout or L-shaped trip you're talking about.
Right.
When we build a new expressway, something else happens. You create a new route for new trips to be formed around. It's what we did when we built the interstate system to begin with. We created whole new patterns of development in the suburbs because people started to live 15 and 20 miles away from town and drive into town. If we build those freeways from the south and the north to connect into Washington County Highway 26, we build new markets for transportation, new markets for housing, new markets for job location that spread us out. They don't necessarily, they demonstrably don't bring more jobs or more public resources or necessarily more people to this region, but they certainly cause people to make location choices which might work for them. Let me get idealistic
That's
and
altruistic. That's what happened with 205, right? When they
look at
205, you're right.
You
it
got
all
a
created.
Ton of stuff along there, and we're sort of at the mode of finishing it up. There's that last stretch at Stafford that the people are salivating over the opportunity to develop. So how
all
do
right, I got to get back to work?
Okay, that's my answer. Take care.
All right. No, I think he raises an idea, but I think the other point you're making is that we have a commitment to trying to crowd up, I guess is the only term to use.
I think we have a commitment to vitality and a vibrant
community really
and great neighborhoods and protecting our natural resources and our countryside.
But one of the effects of that is a wholesale crowding of the old city. The Portland area, and you know,
we could talk about that another hour.
We could. I spent several hours on it, and I'm, for example, very concerned about the developments along Division and elsewhere, where big apartment houses are being built without parking, off-street parking.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I don't want to divert us into that conversation.
Because then I won't get
and
out
you
here.
Have, and you really do have to get out of here. We're with Bob Stacey. We're talking about the Columbia River crossing. We've got other calls. The number to call 231-8187. Who do we got? Who? Jim, you're on the air. Hello?
Hey, yeah, from the Speaker of the House to, you know, all the crowd in Salem, the study's been going on for a long, long time. And
yes.
To me, it's corruption, you know? It's just hard to handle and it's getting
what
old.
What do you mean by corruption?
Oh, it's just, you know, insider vested interest.
Okay, I would agree that there are vested interests.
Yeah,
I'm not sure I'm seeing a pattern of what is classically called corruption here, which would be people getting money under the table or outside of legitimate means.
But I guess it's all in our definition. But
okay.
You know, that's just the way I look at it. So
yeah.
Cheers.
Okay, Jim.
Thanks for the call.
To speak to the interest issue, my brothers and sisters in the labor movement would really like to have some construction jobs. This economy could really use some construction jobs.
Yeah.
And so when you hold out the prospect that there's $3.5 billion worth of construction related employment to build this thing, it's not all going into salaries, but you know, big chunks of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's an almost irresistible thing to support. The objective here should be to put people to work as soon as possible, building the right stuff. And
the right stuff is
the right stuff is you know, not a replacement bridge, but a supplemental bridge to build the lift span on the railroad bridge downstream, to make improvements all along the corridor at a smaller scale. And then, you know, if we're going to have tolling, to apply that money to some other needs on our transportation network.
How did this thing get locked in the way it is? I mean, what was what happened?
They got to yes in that original set of meetings.
And that was it.
Yeah, after that, you got to keep the deal alive. I'm oversimplifying only slightly. We've got key interests, highway lobby, transit lobby, truckers, and you know, you work it together and you try to address the navigation issue,
mm-hmm.
and you push forward with the compromise you can get, and you leave other people at the side and say, we've studied their arguments, and their arguments don't hold water.
Well, it really bothers me on a lot of levels. I see the people of Vancouver, I think wrongly, rejecting a light rail for whatever reasons. But that's their democratic right.
Yeah.
And now we're inventing essentially a rationale for the creation of the very thing that they're rejecting.
Because they get this shiny new bridge.
Right, because they get a shiny new bridge, which they want.
Right.
Well, that seems like bait and switch? What do you want to call it? A very expensive way of getting your way.
Yeah, absolutely. And not getting your way because you have to accept something you're diametrically opposed to in order to get the thing you want. And it's the same on the Oregon side. If you're a transit advocate or a cycling advocate, you're urged to take the improvements that this represents. And the only price you have to pay is, okay, from your perspective, a 10-lane bridge restripable to 12 lanes is a little wide, but is that the end of the world?
Right.
Well, it's a potential disaster economically and in terms of the environment.
But
and our
what it does, is if you live in Irvington or if you live in Sabin or if you live in the inner southeast, all the traffic that would and is snarling often at rush hours up by the crossing moves down and snarls everything up around the already incredibly snarled area around the Coliseum. And now they're already talking about building some immense structure to deal with traffic at the Colosseum.
Right. But they have no money for it.
Well, so in other words, it's just simply going to create a disaster of carbon monoxide,
yes,
and so on.
And cut through traffic and danger to pedestrians and kids and families in North and Northeast Portland. Joe, I should tell your listeners before I go that not only is the Northeast Coalition of Neighborhoods still actively opposing this project, but so is the Coalition for a Livable Future, an organization that was formed to watchdog for the livability and the environmental justice, the equity concerns of the broader community, from a natural resources, fair housing, neighborhood protection, smart development, and environmental justice perspective. And the Coalition for a Livable Future is still doing battle in court in terms of all the pressure points that we've talked about, the state treasurer, the Washington legislature, which still hasn't bungled up its money. They're still engaged in this effort. And so if your listeners want to do something, they should get engaged with the Coalition for a Livable Future.
Okay, well, that's very helpful. Bob, I know you have to go.
Appreciate the time.
And I really appreciate the time you put in. Those of you listening, it's just going to be me and you. You get to call me and talk, but Bob can't give you his authoritative word on things. So thanks very much.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
And I'll let you go. 231-8187 is the number to call. We're talking about the Columbia River Crossing. If you've been paying attention, you know that it has some real, the present plan has some real drawbacks. The need for a new crossing is apparently manifest. The idea of putting a light rail across the Columbia makes obvious sense. The price of getting it there seems to be a new bridge. What do you think? Give us a call, 231-8187. Sean, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning. It seems like the anti-light rail voices in Clackamas County and in Clark County are really loud and obnoxious. And don't get me wrong, I have some respect for some of the opponents of the CRC project. But it seems like we need loud and obnoxious voices on the side of light rail. And it seems like one of the problems we're having in this situation is that there's a kind of timidity in the voices who are in favor of light rail.
What do you mean?
It seems like, you know, they're having the, like you guys were just talking about, how they're having to like pitch this shiny new bridge in order to get light rail across the river, whereas I think even the opponents of light rail would have much more respect for the project if the people in favor of light rail would say, yes, we're going to exercise leadership on this issue. We're going to try and create a much more Western European-style city. We're going to try and get people out of their automobiles. We're going to try and end
the car culture. You mean just be honest, straightforward about it, kind of?
Precisely. Yeah, like, get people out of their darn automobiles.
But you do understand that people in Clackamas County are in wholesale rebellion against light rail right now. Whether that's rational, which I don't think it is, or not, that's one of the political realities. The same is true for Clark County in Washington State. So this is, I think this is a devil's bargain that they've made.
If you take into account the global military empire that's necessary for the perpetuation of the car culture,
yeah,
I think if people just made, you know, lined up these arguments in favor of mass transit and light rail and highlighted the drawbacks of this and the stupidity of the car culture, that we could actually win this argument, and being timid about it and trying to be, you know, evasive about it, it just sets us back. Let's just be out front. Yes, we want to end the car culture. That's what we should be arguing.
Okay, I thank you for the call, and I see your point. Let's go to some other calls. 232-8187. Joanne, you're on the air.
Yes, hello?
Hello.
Yeah, Mr. Stacy.
He's not here anymore.
He's gone. Well, I'll play it anyway. Mr. Stacy, if you were there, I want to say this to you. I got bad health and I am low income and I have no clout or connection in the world. But Mr. Stacy, I thank you for your work and bless you for it. And goodbye, Joe.
Okay, thank you very much for the call. All right, let's hear from some more of you. We got a few minutes left. 231-8187. We're talking about the Columbia River crossing. Tim with a T.
Yeah, I was calling because, I mean, this project is the worst possible project.
How so?
And every politician has, like, signed off on it, including politicians that appeared on their surface from what, you know, for instance, Rex Burkholder, he used to be a real anti-freeway activist, and then he turned into this Columbia River crossing advocate, and now we're down the road, and they're actually trying to ram this thing through, and it's just building more freeway.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering what politicians are out there that are going to stand up on the Oregon side and say, we need something different.
Well, you know, you're raising an interesting point. Back in the day when they planned to do the Mount Hood Freeway, it was Neil Goldschmidt, now disgraced, but his administration and his thinking and the people surrounding him were the ones who changed the PAP process in Oregon in general, where we didn't solve every or try to solve every problem with a freeway.
Right.
And that was where light rail got its power and its birthing.
And I want to address Sean's point a little bit, too, about the light rail. I live near Clackamas County, and I'm kind of sensitive to what the Clackamas County people are thinking. And, you know, part of it is light rail is really not interurban train. Like, for instance, the Better Bridge proposal suggests, improving the time from downtown Vancouver to downtown Portland on the Amtrak lines, as opposed to a light rail into Vancouver, which would not be that fast when you think about it, because there would be stops all the way.
Well, that's true. There would be. There is a good possibility.
And that, you know, in Clackamas County, they're building the light rail down McLaughlin Boulevard, and, you know, the thing you notice is, oh, it's going to simply be duplicating what the 33 bus does right now.
As far as I know, you're right.
And it's like, the 33 bus, which runs every 15 minutes up and down McLaughlin Boulevard, it doesn't cost $1 billion to build. And from the Clackamas County people's point of view, the light rail doesn't service enough people in Clackamas County to justify how much money TriMet wants Clackamas County to dump into it. And so I think we need to empower the smaller communities to, you know, improve all of their transportation a little bit incrementally, and smaller bridges and smaller projects make a lot more sense than these big, giant boondoggles. I mean, hopefully Washington will stop it. And then finally, I mean, the final point I just want to make is, you know, the most obvious thing to do in terms of these bridges is to begin tolling them now in order to raise money to replace them later, and also to lower the traffic on them in general, so that, you know, you can ease the congestion, raise the money without going into debt, and focus on more efficient, better projects. And I agree with the earlier caller that there's the smell of corruption in Oregon politics. I mean, people are being bought off.
Well, I don't know whether they're being bought off commercially or being bought off politically or exactly what's going on. But I do know that there's no, from my perspective, there's no clear-headed analysis going back to the radical, that is, the roots of the problem to try to solve it. For example, I really don't believe that what TriMet is doing with its trains is a solution to the inner city transportation problem. I think we need not only light rail, but we need the same kind of commuter trains that they have on the East Coast and the Midwest. We don't have them. We don't have the money for them. They're not going to happen. But I think you're raising some very important points. I just feel that there's been no real, serious, intelligent discussion amongst all of the players and amongst we ordinary folks who are going to be so impacted by this. And that's why I've been staying on this.
And, you know, Michael Monk, he's a blogger in town. He pointed out that a lot of the environmental groups that had been opposed to the CRC project just kind of folded recently and were not lobbying hard in Salem. I mean, where was the BTA? Where was Sierra Club? Where were Thousand Friends of Oregon? Where were all these other groups that had been opposed to this freeway expansion? They just weren't around. And we really need leadership to stop this boondoggle.
Well, I appreciate your comments. I don't know what happened to the various environmental agencies and interest groups, but you're raising a really good point. That is to say, there seems to be some kind of cultural buy-in here that may not be totally rational. And I don't think the real a real radical solution that addressed more than just that particular corridor ever appeared. Anyway, I want to thank you for the call. I'll give some others an opportunity.
We're
talking about the Columbia River Crossing. Bob Stacey is no longer with us, but I'm here, and I'd like to hear from you. 231-8187. John, you're on the air.
Hello. My comment is about the competence and vested interest also.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, how could anyone not get the correct height requirements from the Coast Guard?
Well, I don't know how that happened. That was a boondoggle of the most absurd sort.
I mean, you or I would be held accountable if you can't get the truck height right and you hit an overpass.
Well, it's kind of like you build a boat inside your basement.
Correct.
You know, how the hell do you get it out?
and they've spent tens of millions there. And my other comment would be about the SkyTram to the Pill Hill. It actually cost 8 times more than what they originally projected.
But it's
comments.
A nice ride.
So, yeah. So, anyhow, thank you for taking
I appreciate your call. And I do think that we do not display a real, intelligent, radical approach to these kinds of very real problems at this point in our development. And probably the most important thing is money is no longer readily available. It's scarce. So every time we allocate for something like this, we're committing ourselves to not doing a bunch of other things about which we are not being honest. All right, I want to hear from you. 231-8187. I think we have time. Tom, is it? Todd.
That's actually Todd over in Vancouver.
Sorry.
Hey, Joe. Real quick, I really appreciate KBU and your program. And,
thank you.
Now that 6:20 a.m. is gone, unfortunately, you guys are one of their
yeah, we're in.
Fresh air. Yeah, hey, I'm a major advocate as a Clark Countyan, although I don't travel into Portland commute-wise, but I'm way in favor of light rail. I'm not sure why these North Clark County Republicans are against putting that in. They think that we're going to have to pay for all of Metro Portland's light rail costs. But I say put a line over 205, loop it up through our mall, and then one up I-5, make the two connect. If they build it now, they will ride it. All of the Clark County people who commute into Portland will ride that light rail like nobody's business. It's a way to avoid the tolls and perhaps rebuilding the I-5 bridge right
we're,
now.
We're out of time. I really appreciate your call. I want to thank everybody. I urge you to stay tuned to KBOO. We're the only people doing the real thing here in Oregon. And we do it pretty well, I think, considering we're all volunteers. You stay tuned. I'll see you next week. And hopefully my air partner, Abe, will be healthier.
This song speaks of the Festival Express, a train and series of concerts traveling across Canada in the summer of 1970 featuring the Grateful Dead, Janis Joplin, Delaney and Bonnie, and many more artists. Come see the film Festival Express Thursday, March 14th at the Clinton Street Theater at this month's KBOO Radio Pictures screening. All ticket sales benefit KBOO Radio and may be purchased now via our website, kboo.fm. Plus, we'll have another short film and a trivia contest for you to match wits with the hosts of KBOO's Grateful Dead and Friends program. That's Festival Express, Thursday the 14th at the Clinton Street Theater. Details and tickets available now at kboo.fm.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First on Alternative Radio, we hear the late historian and activist Howard Zinn speaking on Against War. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints looks at Fukushima 2 years later with excerpts of a global symposium addressing the mounting medical and ecological consequences of the nuclear meltdown in Fukushima, Japan. At 11, on stage and studio, host Dimae Roberts talks with dancer-musician Michelle Fuji, the artistic director director of Portland Tyco about their new spring concert, Insatiable. And we hear Dime's feature story about New Zealand's Black Grace Dance. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Joseph Gallivan talks to abstract painter Deborah Gillis about her show of recent paintings at Butters Gallery and the relationship between landscape and abstract elements in her work. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Now here's Alternative Radio.
So I think our job is not just, we need to stop this war, of course, but we need, I think, also to make up our minds that we are going to carry on a campaign against war, against militarism, against the stealing of our wealth in order to feed the military-industrial complex, in order to feed the egos of our leaders and the profits of the corporations. We need to do that.
That's Howard Zinn, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Howard Zinn, Against War. If an honest history is ever written of the U.S. war on Iraq, it may not be believed. It's 10 years since Washington launched its shock and awe attack on Iraq. Remember? Weapons of mass destruction, Axis of Evil, mobile chemical labs, slam dunks, curveball, smoking guns, mushroom clouds, cakewalks, liberators, regime change, and mission accomplished. The architects of the war, Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Rice, Fife, Wolfowitz, and others, should be doing time instead of having a good time. Today, Iraq is a broken country. Nothing will bring back the hundreds of thousands of Iraqi dead. The U.S. owes Iraq reparations for the destruction it has caused. But being the global superpower means you never have to say you're sorry or face justice. The permanent war economy feeds on conflict and strife. Is it utopian to imagine a different future? Our guest today is Howard Zinn. He was perhaps this country's premier radical historian. He literally changed the way we looked at history by emphasizing the resistance and triumphs of ordinary people. During World War II, he saw combat duty as an Air Force bombardier. He taught at Boston University for many years and was an active figure in the civil rights movement and was among the first to oppose U.S. aggression in Indochina. A principled opponent.